Hello, I'm Will Stein, and welcome to Geography Island Jams. This podcast is in the same style as the BBC Radio 4 Desert Island Disc series, whereby each episode I ask my interviewee what 8 songs, book, and luxury item they would want to take with them if they were stranded on a desert island. For rights reasons, the music has not been included in the podcast. You can find links to the 8 songs on the LSE Geography and Environment website. I hope you enjoy. Welcome to Geography Island Jams. With me today, my guest is Meredith Whitten. Meredith grew up in Fort Worth, Texas, before moving to Austin, Texas, where she lived for 25 years. At the University of Texas, Meredith completed a bachelor's in journalism and a master's in public affairs. She then completed her MSc and PhD in regional and urban planning at the LSE. Her research focuses on green space planning and the role that urban greening plays in addressing impacts stemming from urbanization and processes of urban change. Outside of the LSE, Meredith is a board member for the American Association for Geographers Landscape Speciality Group, and she serves on the Mayor of London's Green Infrastructure Task Force as a consultant to Parks for London. Some fun facts about Meredith. She started her career as a sports journalist. She first met her husband at a party, yet they did not start dating until 22 years later. And finally, she has been to 46 of the 50 US states. Welcome, Meredith.
Hi, Will. Thanks for having me.
I had no idea you started your career as a journalist. What first made you want to do journalism? And when did you decide you wanted to do other things?
When I was in high school, for an English course, I wrote an essay. It was, an essay about Texas was turning 150 years old. And I got to enter the essay into a college level competition and I won first prize. And it was then that I really kind of found that I loved writing. So I joined a high school newspaper and a yearbook and the writing club. And I had a teacher who was really amazing. She'd been a journalist and really kind of inspired me. And so I knew that that's what I wanted to study. And that's when I went off to university, that's what I majored in. And I worked on student publications throughout my degree.
And then what is it that made you want to change to go into, you know, studying green space?
It's funny because at the time I was interested in kind of urban issues. And I had an internship at a magazine. And I remember kind of my mentor there told me, if you want to be a writer on a particular topic, you shouldn't study journalism, you should actually study that topic and then go back and write about it. And of course, he told me this when I was about to graduate, so I couldn't go back and redo my degree. But I realized, you know, I did graduate and I worked, like I said, as a sports journalist for a while, but I always had that interest in urban issues and particularly environmental issues in urban areas. So about 5 years after I finished my bachelor's degree, I went back and got a master's, and that's when I started studying greening issues.
Is there anything you remember most distinctly from studying in Texas?
You know, the state has such a reputation, both internationally and even just, you know, across the U.S. as being a place of cowboys and, you know, wide open spaces and horses. And actually, the state is quite urban. It's more people live in urban areas in Texas than they do in Britain.
Oh, wow.
I find that the people in Texas tend to have a really nice balance between being urban and cosmopolitan, but kind of respecting the land and kind of the history of the state. And that fits really well with the kind of research that I do as well. Maybe that's part of where it came from, just being a Texan in general.
What would you say the biggest differences are between LSE and the University of Texas?
I think probably the most obvious thing for me was, in the U.S., and particularly big state schools like the University of Texas, sports just dominate. Sports are a huge industry, college-level sports. And so, you know, you go to a football game, American football, or you go to basketball games, and they're on campus. And they're so dominant around campus. And when I first got to LSE, I didn't even know we had any sports teams because they're not that visible, especially as a master's student. You know, the matches and the games don't take place actually on the campus, so they're not as visible.
Can you now tell me about the first song you'll be taking with you?
Okay, so I think all of my songs are going to really date me, but the first one is Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears. This song came out when I was in high school, and it was, you know, it was the 80s. It was the summer that I was turning 16, which is when the age we can start driving in the U.S., So there was a lot of the kind of, you know, the Brit pop invasion was happening, and all of my friends were turning 16 and getting their driver's license and getting cars. And I'm one of the younger ones in my class. So by the time I finally turned 16 and got a car, I remember that summer just driving around with my friends, and this was one of our favorite songs. And it's, I mean, within the first three notes, you know that what song it is. And it just, I hear it today and it still just takes me back to that summer of just driving around, you know, Fort Worth, Texas with all of my friends and our new cars.
So how many years have you been at the LSE for?
Well, I came to do my master's in 2006. And then I went back to the US for a little while. And then I came back for the PhD in 2010. So I've been there ever since. Actually, now that I think about it, my first experience with the LSE was in 2005. I was working in Austin for the state legislature, and we had a little bit of time to take off in the summer. So I decided I wanted to come hang out in London for a month, but I couldn't afford a hotel for a whole month. So I took an LSE summer school course so I could stay in the student halls. And that's really kind of where I fell in love with the LSE. You know, so a year later, I came back to do a postgraduate degree.
That's so fun. What a fun way to start. Just what halls were you in?
I lived in Holborn.
Oh, yeah. The one right next to LSE.
Yeah, High Holborn. Yeah, over on... Over on kind of Bloomsbury boundary. And I met, you know, a lot of the people who do summer school are professionals doing kind of continuing education. So there were a lot of people my age. I mean, I was in my 30s when I did that. And we were all living in the dorm, and it was the summer, or it was the week I started the summer school was the week that the tube bombs happened in London. So yeah, I've been at the LSE for 4 days when that happened. And in a way, I think that kind of caused everyone to bond much more quickly than maybe we would have. So I still have really good friends from that first month I ever spent at LSE.
Do you have a favorite place around the LSE?
Actually, I like the gardens over at Temple Inn. They're not undiscovered by any means, but they're, if you go over there, you still kind of feel like you've gotten away from the LSE, but it's really just right around the corner. You know, sometimes they're completely empty, sometimes they're completely rammed, but it's kind of a nice little spot. And you don't see a lot of students there either, which can be nice to kind of get away from all the students that go to Lincoln and Fields.
Do you have a favorite place to eat on campus or favorite LSE meal?
I actually don't eat at the LSE that much. I don't actually eat. I tend to snack, so I go around to all the different places around campus, and they probably all know me because I'm always buying a Coke Zero and something like pretzels or an energy bar. So yeah, I kind of spread my patronage out everywhere. Don't want to show favorites.
Can you now tell me about the second song you'll be taking with you?
Okay, so this song is it's by a band called Nada Surf, and it's called See These Bones. I actually had a hard time deciding which Nada Surf song I would take, but this is one of my all-time favorites. I don't know if you know them. They're a wonderful band. They're based out of New York, although the lead singer lives in Cambridge now. And I like everything they do. They've been very prolific. In fact, they just put out a new album a couple months ago. But this song in particular, it's kind of similar to the first one now that I think about it. The summer before I moved to London for my PhD, my husband and I used to go, well, he wasn't my husband at the time, we were just dating, but we liked to go to a lot of kind of green areas and state parks and natural areas outside of Austin. And we had gone to this place called Enchanted Rock State Park and done a day of hiking in the sweltering Texas temperatures. And the way home is just all through an area called the Hill Country. So it's really beautiful and hilly and lots of trees and deer. And if you've ever met my husband, you know, he's a man of few words. He doesn't talk much. And so the whole way home, I was driving and I just played this Nada Surf CD that I had. And we had the windows down. And, you know, it was one of those where we were very close, but we weren't actually talking. And I remember this song. It reminds me of just being out with Carl, you know, under the big Texas sky.
My next question is, do you have any favorite green spaces in London?
Oh yeah, it's like trying to ask me which of your children is your favorite. I tend to like spaces that are kind of not traditional. You know, when I talk about parks and green spaces, people tend to think about the Royal Parks or kind of more the Victorian inspired spaces. But I like spaces that maybe are a little different. I really like Parkland Walk, which is a linear space that goes from Islington to Haringey. So it's a nature site. It's built on an old disused rail line. The tracks and the platforms are still there. And what I like about that space is it's an incredibly urban space, but you also kind of feel like you're out in the middle of, you know, you're out on a nature walk out, you know, out in the countryside. So I like those kind of spaces that link up other bigger spaces.
So that sort of links onto my next question. Do you have a vision for what the perfect green space would look like?
Yeah, if I did and I could patent that, I'd be a rich woman. what I focus on are green spaces in urban areas. So they tend to be smaller spaces, spaces where you can't forget that you're in the city. So I like spaces ideally that really kind of embrace the fact that they're urban and don't try to kind of, you know, close themselves off from the city around them. I'm not a fan of all the fences and the railings around parks and green spaces. People think that that makes them safer, but research shows it actually doesn't. So I like spaces that you just kind of weave in and out of almost without even knowing it sometimes as you move about the city. And those tend to be kind of newer spaces. You know, sometimes they're even just something like a pocket park. But, you know, you can get this really big green experience just by moving around London and kind of going in and out of all the different types of green spaces we have.
How would you go about valuing green space? Like, do you give it economic value or do you argue it's social value or both?
Yeah, well, that's the big trend right now. There's a lot of research. People in the department are doing research on how you value things like nature and heritage. And, you know, it's called natural capital accounting, where you actually put a dollar or a pound amount on the kind of benefits that you get from green space. So for example, you could say, well, these trees take out this much carbon from the air and that's worth, you know, X amount of money. I think one of the reasons that green space is always considered to be kind of undervalued and underfunded is because there is a bit of an intrinsic value to it. Humans like to be near nature, and it's hard to quantify that. So we have a preference for it, but it doesn't always show up in, you know, the kinds of decisions we make. And I think there's always going to be a bit of tension because it's, you know, trying to monetize nature can also be very problematic as well. So I think there are ways to show that it's contributing to the economy and has economic value, but I think we also need to be cautious about making it solely a commodity.
Fab, can you now tell me about the third song you'll be taking with you?
Okay, so I'm probably picking bands you've never heard of. This is a song called Jagged, and it's by a band called the Old 97s. So the Old 97s are a band from Dallas. They've been around for ages. When I was at university, they were called kind of a college band, and they're still around. In fact, they toured through London not too long ago. But the Old 97s kind of pioneered what's called, I hear it called like Y'alternative. So it's kind of alternative country rock in a way. I'm not a fan of country music, but it's like rock with a little bit of a twang to it. And the Old 97s are, what I like about them is they are even better live than their music is. They're just one of those bands that when you go and hear them, it's the experience makes the music that much better. And so Jagged is one of their older songs, and they're very clever with their lyrics, and I like almost anything they do. So I just picked that one song.
Already knowing you, I know that you like to run. Do you have any favorite running routes in London?
Oh, well, yeah, I think we've talked about this. I've actually had to change my route now that, because of the lockdown. I used to have a route that went through several public parks, and some of the parks have banned runners and cyclists, so I've had to change things. I now have this route. I really like it. I live in Southwest London, and so I head out towards Wimbledon, and there's a lot of really big hills, so I get kind of a workout from that. And then I go down through Wimbledon Village and back around through Wimbledon Common and Putney Heath. So I get this kind of very urban experience of running on the roads, and then I get to go through the Common. You know, I see a fox now and then. It's kind of this really variety of experiences. Um, and And then I kind of come back up through Putney and along the Thames. So it's a route I probably wouldn't have ever found if we hadn't had the lockdown. But yeah, that's one of my, I think it's about 8 miles.
Oh, wow. What about London generally? Do you have any favorite spots in London that aren't green spaces?
Gosh, you know, it's like I've been here so long, yet I feel like, you know, I've barely touched the surface of everything to see. When I first lived in London, doing my master's, I lived near Borough Market. And that was before it got really discovered and, you know, overrun with tourists. And I still like to go over kind of in that area, especially in the winter when there's not as many people. And it just, I like the feel of that area a lot. I have, when I moved to London for my master's, a friend gave me this, it was a box of walks. And there were 50 different walks and I did them all. And they took me through all kinds of parts of London that maybe I wouldn't necessarily have been to. And I still feel like, you know, I haven't seen anything almost. It's amazing. But just going down, you know, streets that are, you know, kind of have that conservation area vibe to them, like Covent Garden. I mean, you can kind of close your eyes and feel like you're in the middle of, you know, Victorian England still.
So now your fourth song?
So my fourth song is I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles. So when I was growing up, my mom, she was a stay-at-home mom and she loved music. Her stepdad had been an agent for a lot of celebrities, played music, and she played the Beatles all the time. And I can remember, you know, her and we just danced up, you know, the living room to all the Beatles songs. So I knew about the Beatles before I really even knew about, you know, London or England, or Liverpool. You know, I knew who the Beatles were.
If you could invite anyone in the world to a dinner party, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
I think it would be Frederick Law Olmsted. So he is, he's kind of known as the father of landscape architecture. And he started out as a journalist, kind of like me. But he's famous for designing a lot of urban parks, particularly in the US, so like Central Park in New York. And he actually was very inspired by his trips to England, like Birkenhead Park near Liverpool. But he really kind of pioneered that idea of an urban park. And I would love to be able to ask him questions. Hopefully they would be, you know, kind of informed questions now, because I would just like to know more about where he got his ideas, because they're still so relevant. His work still gets cited by landscape architects and designers today.
And my next question, do you have a favorite dish that you like to eat?
I do. It's kind of a joke. It's called queso, which means cheese in Spanish. And you don't see it in Europe, but it's ubiquitous, especially in the Southwest United States. So it's kind of this melted cheese with a lot of spices in it. And it gets served with tortilla chips. And I could just eat that nonstop. It's usually made with this particular type of cheese, which is called Velveeta. To be honest, I'm not sure it's really cheese. It's just heavily processed. and they don't sell that here. So we have a friend who is a pilot for BA, and he flies to the US a lot. And so he'll bring me these big, dense bricks of Velveeta cheese. Wow. And so we can make queso here.
You've made me hungry from that.
They're really, it's so good. And these bricks are, I mean, they're really dense. And so, you know, to ask someone who's coming to visit to bring you some is kind of a big ask, because it weighs down their luggage. And so, you know, it's like gold if I can get a hold of it. You know?
Can you now tell me about your fifth song?
Okay. So I could not include a song by Duran Duran. So I've included Hungry Like the Wolf. Again, totally dating myself, but I was a massive Duran Duran fan when I was younger. And I remember when, like, people started getting MTV, and my parents didn't want to get cable, so I'd have to go to my friend's house to watch Duran Duran videos. And they, again, they were kind of like I said, with Tears for Fears, they were, you know, part of that kind of Britpop invasion. And one of the things I always think about with them is I was only allowed to put one poster up in my room when I was a teenager, because I had wallpaper and my mom didn't want me poking holes in all the wallpaper. So I put a poster up of the lead singer of Duran Duran, a guy called Simon Le Bon. And about 3 years ago, my husband and some friends and I were at a pub in kind of the Putney Barnes area. And lo and behold, there was Simon Le Bon sitting there with some other people, because he apparently lives in around the same area. Wow. And I just thought, if I could go back in time and tell like 15-year-old me that I would be at a pub in London with the lead singer of Duran Duran, you know, it would make my day. Nobody went up and said anything to him. We just admired him from afar. But I really liked them. You know, it was one of those, anytime Hungry Like the Wolf came on, it just made me want to stand up and start dancing.
Apart from journalism, did you have any childhood ambitions when you were growing up?
When I was really young, you know, we had career day at school. I remember I embarrassed my parents because I told everyone I wanted to be a waitress. I've moved on from that and went on to aspire to other things. Yeah, to this day, I still would love to be like a novelist. You know, I'd like to be able to write just kind of for the joy of writing. You know, if I could be J.K. Rowling, I would in a heartbeat. I'm not that creative and talented as she is, of course. But yeah, I mean, I've switched careers a couple of times, and I think that's partly just because I'm interested in a lot of things. It's not that I get bored or I can't commit. I'm constantly learning and kind of changing what I'm inspired by and what I want to do. And they all relate somehow. But you know, if you had told me, you know, 20 years ago, do you want to be a planner? I would have said no. And now I'm, you know, I'm really happy that I'm a planner, and I see how much, you know, influence planners have. So I'm good right now, but everything I've wanted to be, you know, it keeps shifting.
And then the final one before the next song, do you have any favorite all-time TV shows or films?
That's a good question. It's funny, I've been rewatching during the lockdown. I've been binge watching Parks and Recreation again, which is an American sitcom with Amy Poehler. It's even funnier the second time around. I love it because I worked for local, state, and federal government. And so it's just so spot on, and it's kind of, it's satirical approach that how government, you know, working in a government office is, but it also of course has a lot to do with parks and recreation. And I love that. Yeah. I think we're about to finish the next to last season. I might start it over a third time after that.
I just think the whole thing is just so clever, and it just seems so well put together. I just love the whole thing.
Yeah. Like the way that the parks people and the libraries people are always kind of, you know, in conflict. That's true. You would think, you know, they'd be on the same side, but it's no, it's like, you know, you're battling for limited resources, and it's always parks versus libraries. And it's just so accurate. I love it.
I didn't realize. Can you now tell me about the sixth song you were taking with you?
Okay. So changing it up just a bit, it's a song called A Midwinter Waltz, and it's by a Scottish Irish Celtic band called The Boys of the Low. So it's a waltz. It's kind of got a lullaby feel to it. You know, it's there's no singing or anything, no lyrics. And it's just simply beautiful. It doesn't matter how stressed or, you know, hyper or anything I am. If I just listen to this song, it just makes me calm and serene. I had wanted to have this song played when I got married, but Carl and I basically eloped, so we didn't have a reception or anything. So we got married around Christmas. And so every year on our anniversary, we play this song and we kind of dance around, and it's got that kind of winter, well, like I said, it's called A Midwinter Waltz, and it's got that very kind of peaceful, snow-covered mountain kind of feel to it. And it's a good song to play every year.
Do you have any pet peeves, anything which bothers you way more than anything else?
Carl would tell you I have a lot. well, one thing, so I worked a lot as a copy editor. Even, you know, when I was in college, and then after, you know, professionally, I've done a lot of editing, and I unfortunately don't do well with grammar mistakes, and not so much misspellings, but, you know, little things that are very easy to do, like using it's and putting an apostrophe when it shouldn't. And I mean, Carl used to say, like, he can't take me to a restaurant because I end up editing the menu. It's something I can't turn off, and I would never, you know, call someone out on it. I wouldn't tell the restaurant owner your menus are horrible because they're grammatically incorrect or something. But inside, you know, I'm suffering. So.
Oh, that was quite fun. If you were given a magic wand, is there anything you would change about the world?
Well, I don't want to get political, but there are a few politicians I'd like to make disappear. No, I think I would probably make the world a greener place, like not just kind of traditional parks. I think, you know, sometimes you see those architect renderings of what a development's going to look like, and they're always just covered in greenery and they never end up looking like that. And I do wish sometimes that we could actually integrate nature into our daily experience more than we actually do. Like, I wish we could actually make those make-believe drawings come true.
Can you now tell me about the seventh song you'll be taking with you?
It's a song called The Hardest Place to Find Me by The Rifles, who are a London band. There's nothing particularly special about the song. It's just, it's really kind of peppy, and I like music that kind of, you know, you can kind of get up and it kind of motivates you and makes you feel like, you know, you want to dance or put you in a good mood. And I find a lot of what The Rifles put out is like that. My brother is a big music fan. He's got like 6 trillion CDs or something. But he makes me playlist a lot, and he always tells me he puts peppy songs on. He calls them Meredith songs because he knows I really like, you know, the kind of upbeat peppy things. So I think that's where I first heard this song, was a playlist that my brother put together for me.
What does peppy mean, or pep?
Peppy, kind of upbeat, and, you know, kind of not hyper, but just kind of energetic. Yeah, peppy is just a way to just kind of describe certain songs. And like my family, you know, always tells me I'm peppy because I'm usually the one who's like, let's do this, let's do that, and kind of upbeat. And so I guess, you know, the music I tend to like kind of reflects that.
Oh, I see. Maybe the last for you. If you go back in time 5 years, is there anything you wish you could tell yourself?
5 years. 5 years ago, I was working on my PhD. So I would probably go back and tell myself, you know, not to be so stressed about it, that I should be more confident, and that, you know, it will happen. And I think I'm very guilty of having a plan, which makes sense since I study planning, but having a plan and kind of getting distraught if things don't go to plan. And the older I get, the more I realize you can't really control anything. But I think with a PhD, you can often feel like you have no control whatsoever. You're just kind of drowning in it. And I think it would help me a lot if I could go back and just tell myself that things may not go as I planned, but they'll be okay.
Do you have a personality trait which you're most grateful for?
Yeah, I guess one thing I think is okay about me is I think I'm fairly friendly. I like people. I genuinely like talking to people. Even before social media, where we were all connected, I always did a really good job of staying in touch with people. And I like that I have friends from all different kinds of experiences throughout my life. And, you know, I have friends in countries all over the world, friends who are very different from me and friends who are very similar to me. And that, you know, I'm kind of a consistent, loyal friend to all of them, because I find, you know, that makes my life so much richer. You know, it's not a completely selfless thing. I get a lot out of having friends. You know, I have friends like you, Will, who are much younger than me, and I have friends who are, you know, in their 80s, and I think everyone, you know, brings something kind of inspiring, and I hope I'm as good as I think I am about being a good friend back.
And my final question: do you have a favorite part of being at the LSE?
It kind of builds on what I just said. Probably the thing I like most about the LSE is just the diversity of the students, of the staff, of ideas, you know, of experiences. When I was working on my PhD, I spent most of my time in one of the PhD rooms in St. Clement's, and, you know, no one else was doing similar research. No one else was even studying planning at the time. And just the conversations and things I learned from other people about either, you know, their cultural backgrounds or their educational backgrounds or their experiences. I mean, that made my degree so much stronger and what I learned so much stronger and than if I just, you know, sat at the computer and studied on my own. And I love the University of Texas, where I did a bachelor's and a master's, but it doesn't have that kind of international component to it that the LSE does. And I just think that's why I, you know, keep staying at the LSE. It's because I don't find that anywhere else.
Can you now tell me about your eighth and final song?
Okay, so this one is Woman of the World by Amy McDonald. So this song, well, first, I think Amy MacDonald is awesome. She is this kind of petite Scottish woman who has the most powerful voice. When you see her, you can't believe that such a powerful voice can come out of such a petite person. And I've seen her live several times, and she's just as wonderful live as her music is. But this song came out around the time I was finishing my PhD. So you tend to have a moment when you're finishing your PhD of, on the one hand, you feel like you've accomplished something, but you're also kind of like, oh my God, what next? You know, it's almost like you lose a little bit of confidence because the PhD has been your identity for so long. And so this song is all about being kind of a confident woman, you know, being independent and really just kind of going out and taking life and doing something with it. And so the timing of the song, I think, was what made it such a memorable song for me as well.
So now you're allowed to take with you the Bible, the Beveridge Report, and a book of your choice. What book are you going to take with you?
I think I would probably take a book called A Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold. So I don't know if you know A Sand County Almanac. It's Aldo Leopold was an environmentalist, an American environmentalist. And it's A Sand County Almanac is really just kind of a collection of his essays. And it's kind of about how he became an environmentalist, and it's, the book is considered really a landmark in the American conservation movement. And I remember reading it, I think for the first time when I was in graduate school in Austin. And, you know, it was written, and I think he wrote it in like the 1940s or 50s, and just how relevant some of his ideas still were, and kind of, it really kind of changed. I mean, in his essays, he goes on about how his idea about the environment changes. And if you read his essays, it's almost like you get converted as well. He has a really interesting story about, it's kind of one of the more famous ones, about when he was hunting, and this is before he kind of had this epiphany, and they killed a wolf. And so they go over to the wolf, and the wolf is dying. And in the essay, he talks about seeing the green fire go out of the wolf's eyes. And it was like at that moment, he realized how integral, like all different kinds of, how integral like an ecosystem approaches. And because he had thought, you know, if we kill all the wolves, there'll be more deer to hunt. And he just kind of had this epiphany. And it's a really powerful essay. And I remember reading it at a time where I was, really starting to study more environmental issues. And to have someone kind of explain to you how they became an environmentalist and aware of conservation issues, instead of just kind of assuming we should all just automatically feel that way, was really powerful.
Finally, can you tell me what luxury item you will be taking with you?
Oh, didn't you tell me I couldn't pick anything that was connected or any internet ready devices?
Yeah, you can't have anything which connects you to the outside world or helps you escape.
Well, I don't know if this is kind of a cop out of an answer, but I would probably take, I mean, it's the one thing I take with me when I go anywhere. I would take like maybe some really nice notebooks and pens for writing, because I'm a writer. Whether I'm writing a letter to a friend or writing a thesis, I like to write, and I tend to write things by hand first before I type up a document. And one of my friends said that I must have handwritten 100,000 words of my thesis, because I was always over there on the desk handwriting everything. So I would probably do that, and maybe also if I found an empty bottle, I'd have a piece of paper I could stick a note in.
I'm sure I can give you that. Throw in a bottle as well, maybe a few. Fab. Well, thank you, Meredith, for talking me through your Geography Island jams.
Oh, thank you, Will. It was fun.